Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Ramin Sheth. And Ramin, his Twitter bio speaks for itself. He runs an eight-figure revenue bootstrap business. He invests a few million a year in startups, and he interviews interesting folks on his own podcast. So with all that being said, this episode was filled with knowledge bomb after knowledge bomb. I really enjoyed learning about how he runs a company, and I think you'll enjoy that as well. If you have any thoughts about this episode, let me know on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda, also on Instagram at @HeyDannyMiranda. And if you get a chance, check out the YouTube version of this podcast on YouTube at youtube.com/DannyMiranda. Thank you, as always, for listening. And without further ado, this is my conversation with Ramin Sheth.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Ramin, thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time. I'm really excited to get into it today.
Yeah, Danny, thanks so much. I'm a big fan, so I appreciate it.
Hell yeah. So I'd love to start with you as the captain of the debate team, because it's really interesting. One of my most recent guests said that if they could give their child anything, it would be to be on the debate team, and that would be so important. So was that a foundational experience for you, and how did that help serve you doing what you're doing today?
Oh man, I'm going to sound like such a nerd. That's funny. I wonder who that guest is. That's an interesting, that's what they would give their kid. No, jokes aside, debate was really, it was really foundational for me. I think there are, so a couple of things I can kind of take you back a little bit. So did debate in high school. There's two types of debate, if you're aware, or two kind of primary types: policy debate and Lincoln Douglas debate. Policy debate is where you advocate for or against a resolution. And Lincoln Douglas debate is a little bit more like moral, philosophical, et cetera, in nature. It was actually named after Abe Lincoln and Stephen Douglas when they were debating in the 1850s over things like slavery, you know, secession, et cetera. So it's a very kind of logical, ethical, moral kind of topics, kind of structure of debate. Our high school was really good at policy debate. There were like 40 or so kids on the team. Policy debate was like kind of synonymous. It wasn't even you joined the debate team. It was effectively like the policy team was the debate team. But there was one person at our high school that did Lincoln Douglas debate. She was a year older than me. And that was it. There was nobody else that did it, et cetera. And I just distinctly remember going to the info session, learning a little bit more, and just being really interested in the Lincoln Douglas side versus the policy side, which was like total heresy. It was the non-popular thing to do, if there's such a thing as being popular and debate. Those two words don't really go together. But it struck something a little bit deeper into me. So I got really into LD debate. I was pretty good at it. And I think a couple of the things that kind of came out of it was, you know, first is I was really attracted to there only being two of us and kind of figuring it out. I think it's very emblematic of a startup. I wouldn't have said kind of at that point in time, that's what I knew I was kind of geared towards, but building something from scratch, right? Versus joining something, you know, that was already working, kind of status quo. Most of the people were already kind of there. So there was kind of that subtle piece, I think, that was interesting about my experience. I think the second part, and this is probably what you were getting to more in your question, is this style of debate, kind of the debate ethos, really fit my personality well, right? Lincoln Douglas specifically was really kind of less combative, but much more logically rigorous and big picture oriented than policy or some of the other types of debate. Both of those elements, I'd say, have been pretty consistent mainstays in my journey. I think the thing about debate that I would agree with your guest that said, you know, they would kind of give that as a gift to their kid. The part that I really agree with that about is I think you develop two things through debate that are really important undercurrents in your life. One of which is, I think you have the ability to take both sides of the argument. I think that's really important, especially in, you know, a hyper-polarized world that we're in right now, whether it's politics, whether it's other things, et cetera. I think it's actually really important to be able to be logically rigorous, intellectually honest, and take both sides of the conversation. I think the second thing, probably three things. I think the second thing is it really gives you the ability to empathize with that other perspective. So when you're forced to take two sides of the debate, you find empathy in other people's perspectives. And what you find kind of when you're building businesses, investing, startups, et cetera, that empathy is incredibly important to understand, you know, what's right, what's wrong. And most challenges in business are not black and white, right? And so understanding that becomes really important to have that empathy. And then I think the third piece is just the ability to articulate, right? I mean, so many businesses, when I look, and I look at this all the time when I'm investing in companies, is really a function of how well can they tell their story, right? How compelling is their narrative? And oftentimes it has nothing to do with the underlying business per se, but it has to do with the personality, the intentionality, the framing, et cetera, that the founders can bring to the table. And that makes and breaks companies, right? I mean, that's your ability to hire people, to raise funds, to, you know, challenge and challenge customers to take that journey with you when you're really nothing, et cetera, right? So I think those are the three pieces that really kind of came out of the debate side personally for me. And I think are super, you know, transferable and useful elements, you know, for anybody in anything really that they're doing.
What common elements have you found with founders who can state their vision clearly and make others excited to hear it?
Yeah. I mean, I think ultimately, like, it's funny because we kind of treat this idea of like sales as kind of like a dirty career, right? Like sales kind of like historically you think of it as like slimy or like the used car salesman or maybe, you know, not the smartest people go into sales jobs. Like there's kind of this like adage around sales. But I think the reality is like any job where you're trying to change something, right? Whether you're running your own local corner store or, you know, you're the biggest, baddest funded startup on the block. When you're at the top, it's a sales job, right? Everything is a sell and everything is a negotiation. I like to say that, right? Which is basically you're selling candidates, you're selling customers, you're selling partners, you're selling investors. Everything is a sell, right? And then the close is everything is a negotiation, right? To actually get all of those people to work with you is some sort of give and take and some sort of negotiation. And so I think founders that are able to sell, and especially in tech startups where there's so much kind of adage and acclaim for kind of engineering founders or technical founders, et cetera, it's really the ones I look at that, you know, have that ability, obviously, because otherwise you can't build the product, but really have the ability to sell and kind of bend the world to their will. Super important. I think it's very hard to run a company and grow a company if you don't have that muscle, and you don't have to have it innately. You can either develop it, you can hire for it, et cetera, but you have to have that on the leadership team because otherwise it's really hard to inspire people, whether it's internally or externally, to want to take their most precious resource, which is their time, and allocate it towards you.
Could you give an example?
Yeah. So there's a founder. There's a really good founder. I won't state the name of the company, but I can kind of give an example, which is it's a really good founder I know, had a brilliant idea. It was in the labor space, right? So there's a lot of obviously like future work kind of startups that are coming up right now. This was a couple years ago. So, you know, the tides were kind of turning in that direction, but it wasn't like the topic of the hour per se. Founder was super smart engineer, right? Super smart technical founder, and had this plan, you know, for a product and a company and et cetera, and had built out the MVP. Had spoken with about 60 VCs, could not raise more than $500,000. Okay. Again, brilliant engineer, great MVP, market makes a ton of sense, couldn't raise more than $500,000. Introduced him to somebody else who was also a good mutual friend of sorts. They really hit it off well. They decided to become co-founders. And this person, like their job literally was framing, storytelling. I mean, like world class at this skill. And why I thought they'd be the perfect fit together. Fast forward, they're only 4 years old. Fast forward, and they've raised $70 million. They've already had acquisition. They had acquisition offers 2 years in, where they would personally have walked away with, you know, 15, 20 million bucks each. And the whole tide of that company and the trajectory has completely changed. Not because the product was any fundamentally different, not because the market thesis was any fundamentally different, but the ability to articulate and communicate, and not just raise from investors, but to hire those, you know, 10 amazing people and take them away from roles in which they were doing, you know, they were driving significant impact or making, you know, really good economics, et cetera, right? To convince those first 5-10 customers to take a shot on them when the incumbent solution, you know, has 5,000 customers and are very well-respected SaaS names, right? So it was amazing to kind of see that upfront and close and personal. I think that was probably the biggest impact story where I had a personal impact, but I've seen it time and time again with the companies we've invested in, right? Which is, you know, we've seen just kind of brilliant founders, and whether they're technical, whether they're non-technical, but not having that muscle of the ability to sell and kind of frame and narrate is a challenge, right? It's especially a challenge right now where the market, I think, for candidates has never been hotter or more competitive, right, than ever before. So yeah, super, super important skill. And I think really just, it's not a nice to have, it's a must have when you're building a business.
How does that feel that you were the person, at least in part, responsible for the complete upward trajectory of something incredible happening for an individual who is struggling in that moment? How does that feel for you personally?
I think it's kind of you to say, but I think it's the, you know, I think the funny thing when you're an operator and you're growing a business is you realize how much the hard work is really with the operators, right? I think when you're investing in a business, it's super easy, right? Like to be totally transparent, it's so easy compared to actually starting something and doing something. So yeah, I mean, it feels great. I think those are actually the kinds of things that investors, by the way, can be really helpful with. It's often challenging for investors to get really deep on, you know, the product strategy or the, you know, the hiring strategy or whatever it might be, because you're not talking, you know, to the founder super, you're not living and breathing the problem every single day, right? And so armchair advice actually more often than not can be highly destructive, right? As opposed to constructive. But I think the hard work at the end of the day is the people that are building these businesses, right? Mm-hmm. And I know, because I'm building a business and, you know, and we have a little over 100 folks and it's hard, right? It's really, really hard, right? So it feels great. It's awesome. But I mean, let's put it this way, the connection was made, but I wasn't the one in the room raising, you know, $60, $70 million, you know, building the product, getting the customers, et cetera. That's, you know, that's ultimately on the founders.
You mentioned that building your current business is hard. What's the hardest part about what you're doing today?
Yeah, I think I didn't really appreciate this until I didn't appreciate this when I was at the startup that I was at and I was hired in, but I appreciated this more kind of so I've been hired in as a professional CEO, right? So not a founder, but we have a pretty at scale business and running it. I think I appreciated this a lot more so in being at the top, which is, business at the end of the day is a people problem, right? So whether you're dealing with, we talked about a couple of different groups, right? Customers, partners, employees, et cetera. Business is basically a people problem every single day. And I think when you're in the top rungs of your organization, whether it's 20 people or 5,000 people, the things that are boiling up to the top are typically the things, you know, when you've hired capable people, you have a capable org structure, et cetera, are typically the things that those folks either can't solve, not because of capability, but they just can't solve it, right? They don't have the resources, they don't, you know, whatever it might be. It might be that they can't solve it because of capability. They don't have the knowledge, they don't have the experience, they don't have, you know, all the information at their hands. Or they might not be able to solve it because of authority, right? Like it might be a critical decision to make and it might be, you know, outside the scope of kind of their authority or responsibility. And so the problems that boil up to the top are typically the hardest ones. And typically 80% of the time they're people ones, right? Some customers not happy, there's a fire drill. You know, some employees not happy. You know, they're getting recruited away, they need to get paid more, or you know, they're not feeling fulfilled, or a team is not gelling, or you know, a partner is not happy or whatever it might be, it's people issues. And I think people issues are really challenging because people are complicated, right? And people come from very different directions, very different value sets, very different perspectives, which makes people awesome, right? And which makes kind of the combination and the potential, I think, of the right people getting together so magnanimous and so amplified. But it also can make the challenge of, you know, people working together very, very complex, right? So I think the interesting thing actually also, and I've learned this a lot kind of investing in over 50 companies now, is, you know, whichever sector a business is in, whichever kind of business model it's in, whichever geo, you know, it's in, et cetera, businesses ultimately boil down to people problems and people challenges. And if you unpack that, you know, there's logical parts of people and there's illogical parts of people. There's rational and there's irrational, right? There's the emotional, there's the non-emotional. And that's the challenge, right? I mean, your organization is not just software and robots that say, hey, Danny, go do this. And then they do it without any feelings, any doubts, any thoughts, any concerns, any anxiety, like whatever it might be, right? So like number one, two, and three in any business, I think the challenges are people challenges. And then I think the businesses that really grow and kind of succeed in spite of that. And I say that to say that, you know, it's basically the organizations that figure out how to really harness the positives of people while working through kind of the downsides of the challenges of people, which we all have, right? Which every single one of us has, right?
If you know that you're going to open your phone or open your laptop and there's going to be 1,000 fires for you to deal with on any given day, how do you maintain a positive or at least a headspace that allows you to interact with those problems the most effective way?
Yeah, I think it's two things. I think one is taking a step back and kind of the relationship I described between founder and investor. I feel pretty similarly between kind of, let's say, management and the rest of everybody else, which is it's an incredibly privileged position to be in, to be in that position, right? So I think maintaining perspective, maintaining gratitude, right, that you're in that position to kind of make those calls, make those, you know, decide how the shots are going to play out, et cetera, is really important. Having that perspective, I think, enables and allows you to then take step two, which is to say, great, I've gotten my mind right. I've gotten the framework of kind of how I want to think about this the right way. Now, how do I actually tactically go do it, right? I think the tactical of how you go do it is actually kind of breaks into a couple other component parts. But the most important one, and this has definitely been a learned piece for me that I'll share with you, Danny, is really actually fighting your own urge and resisting actually getting involved too early or preemptively in a fire. And what I mean by that is that's something that's really actually taken a bit of time for me as I have seasoned as a CEO to see that actually not getting involved in that first response in the email or letting the problem kind of stew a little bit for a couple hours, et cetera. Oftentimes 60 to 70% of those seemingly start out as fire drills that have more people on the chain than not and can kind of get resolved to good accord without even getting involved. It's a very fine line, which is to say that if you let genuine problems fester, they start as snowballs and they turn into boulders. They either crush you or you spend an exorbitant amount of energy, you know, kind of pushing that boulder up the hill, right? So it's also a lot of it is judgment in understanding, you know, what are the types of issues that you do need to get involved with and what are the types of issues that it's actually okay to have a little bit of that imperfection, a little bit of that messiness in your organization. Because while solving this issue or this particular challenge may be a little bit messy, by not interceding, it's going to pay dividends for when we have to solve the next challenge and the next challenge and the next challenge.
What are the commonalities you see in the 60 to 70% of problems that resolve themselves versus the problems that you actually need to tackle right away?
Yeah, I think the 60 to 70% that end up resolving themselves end up being functions of miscommunication, people not having all of the information that other people might have, right? So thinking something is a bigger deal than it's not, or, you know, think it is a big deal for your job or your team. It might not be as big of a deal for somebody else, but I think the vast majority of the time it is a misalignment as a miscommunication. And it's important to actually bifurcate those types of issues, because as a CEO, I typically have the worst information of everybody that's on that chain, right? So to find out the right information, I can give guidance, I can give perspective, you know, I can exercise judgment, but I'm actually at a disadvantage because I have the least amount of information that everybody else on that chain probably has. And so the way that I would tackle that problem is I would have to go ask everybody what's going on. And then basically from that point in time, kind of make a judgment call. Typically what I find is kind of my VPs or my second line of management has enough context and enough information, right, where they can kind of plug the holes, right? Or they can provide that and then folks can plug the holes themselves. I think the 30% of issues that you do really need to get involved with are either ones in which A, you know, everybody doesn't have that information. It's actually the inverse. It's information you have that other people don't have. And it might or might not be comfortable or uncomfortable to share it, right? And you kind of have to make that call. Whether it's going to be, you know, guys, we need to do this. And you basically rely a little bit on trust capital and social capital from the team, or you actually share, you know, this is the case, and then kind of let the chips fall how they may fall. I think that's one bucket. I think the second bucket, and this is probably the more prominent bucket, is we don't have an opportunity to mess up. So I'll give you an example. We have a new client right now. Our business has been fortunately scaling tremendously well over the last year or so. And we have a new client that we've recently picked up that wants to do a big project with us. And it requires us to put a meaningful amount of resources behind it and deliver, you know, as well as we can to basically capture the revenue opportunity. Where there's gaps, or there may be knowledge gaps of, hey, how do we do this? Or, hey, do we have the right teammate? Or, hey, do we need to hire more people, or whatever it might be? And there's a fire, let's say, that goes on with that type of situation. That's one that I get directly involved in. And that is not one which is kind of in the former framework I was sharing, which is it's okay to have a little bit of slack and kind of let a little bit of the messiness, because the repeat player kind of comes out and that works out kind of downstream. This is the type of example where it's a little bit the opposite, which is we can do things that don't scale to make sure we 100% nail this. Because the reality is that if we nail this, there's going to be more than enough opportunity, additional opportunity that comes out of this. And so we do not have an option to fail. We have to nail this 100% right. And whatever that means, whether that means from me to the most junior person on the team, working however many hours it requires to absolutely nail this for the client, we have to do that, right? And so I always try to look at a fire as one in which, A, the first question is it truly a fire? Is it not a fire, right? There's a filtration piece. But of the ones that are truly a fire, I think a lot of them are ones in which they're misalignment issues, miscommunication issues, misinformation issues. They can be resolved. And those are kind of light touch, light guidance posts. Ideally, I don't get involved. Sometimes I get involved a little bit, but they can be, you know, kind of resolved. And candidly, like, I have good VPs, like they can solve it better than I can even, right? And they're, you know, they're where I think I'm a bit stronger than most of them horizontally. They're a lot stronger than me vertically, right? And that's why they have a really good domain set of expertise and why they're kind of in their roles, right? And so it's important for me also to not chime in too much because I can actually give worse advice, candidly, or worse perspective than some of those domain experts, right? For the 30% in which there's not an opportunity to fail, those are the ones in which, you know, part of it might be a control freak thing, but those are the ones I'm definitely involved in.
It's so fascinating hearing you talk. I can't help but think of a passion of yours, which is the NBA and basketball coach leading the way. Whereas LeBron James's personal coach, his stretching coach, might know exactly what he might need for his hip or whatever it may be. You're leading the charge. You're his head coach for that team. And it's so fascinating because the parallels to business and sports are nonstop. Do you study coaches in professional sports to help guide your own role? And if so, what have you learned from that process?
Yeah, I am a huge basketball junkie. I went to Duke, so I of course love, you know, I'm a big college basketball fan. I've got a couple friends in the NBA, and I'm a big pro basketball fan as well. And what I always learn from them when we talk is actually how similar being a world-class athlete and being an entrepreneur, a founder, a CEO is, right? And I think the biggest thing that I've learned actually from them is really this ability to kind of hone in focus, understand what is most important, and then be content with yourself. Like, you have this constant inner dialogue that's going on, right? Like, every day I have days where, you know, the outside story sounds great, but there I wake up with doubt. I wake up with anxiety. I wake up with confidence. I wake up with energy. I mean, you're complicated as a person, right? And you know, when you're running a business, there's some days you feel like you're going to take over the world and like you're going to grow into this just amazing, amazing organization. And like everything is kind of, you know, built out for you. And then there's some days you feel like, man, everything is breaking. Like, are we going to be in business in a year? Now, we're fortunately not in that situation, right? Where we are going to be in business. We're very fortunate to be in the position we're in, but you're, it's all on a relative pull, right? Right. Breaking or succeeding is relative to kind of where you are at that point in time. So the biggest thing that I've gotten really into actually because of a lot of these friends actually has been the mindset game, and has been starting to be, I'm by no means an expert at this, but starting to be a lot more intentional about mindset practices, about kind of reflection practices. It's actually why I've gotten so much more active on Twitter. You know, 6 months ago, like I had 1,000 followers, I'd never spent any time on Twitter. And candidly, you know, in all the writing or the content I put out, et cetera, it's awesome that, you know, people read it and people have, it's resonated with people and it's been engaging, but it's really therapeutic for me, right? Like it's really a way for me to put out in a structured way, how do I take the jumble of kind of what's in my brain or what's happening kind of day in, day out, and actually put some sort of rhyme or reason or sense to it, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing, I'm a huge sports fan. I think the biggest thing to draw away, there's a lot of kind of like tactical things, but I think the biggest thing is really mindset and focus and having kind of that self-awareness and understanding how to harness, you know, yourself and really just, you know, knowing where your energy sits. That sounds like super fluffy, but it really is important, which is this idea of like, what are you good at? What does your company need? Like, what do you enjoy? Right. And like, what's the intersection of that Venn diagram? Right. So yeah, that's kind of been my biggest learning from these folks.
So take us through some additional mindset routines or practices you do other than just crystallizing your thoughts on Twitter, if you have any that come to mind.
I think that's been the biggest and probably most visible one lately, right? Which is really kind of crystallizing. Another one that I do is I intentionally spend like, let's call it 2.5 hours a week, like probably like 5-ish conversations, like half an hour conversations, with just really interesting people. And I kind of bifurcate it into like at least one or two people I don't know I'm meeting a week, you know, one person I know decently well, and just strengthening the relationship, and then two people I do know well. And what I find from that is it's a really nice kind of basis for me from a mindset perspective to see what else is going on in the world. What are the kinds of things that, you know, I can resonate with folks about? Because like I said, you know, when you're in peer groups of other founders, other CEOs, et cetera, most of your challenges boil down to people problems. It doesn't really matter what kind of business you're running. That's typically your challenge, right? You can't hire someone, you're dealing with a customer, employees, you know, upset, not upset, like whatever it might be. And so kind of trading frameworks and stuff. So I think I'd almost distill it into like, it's like one to many, which is like Twitter for me, which is I'm putting my thoughts out into the world. And like, if people engage, great. If they don't, doesn't really matter. But people have really been engaging, which has been great, right? There's kind of the like one to one, which is like really kind of talking to, you know, other people, et cetera. There's the many to one, which is like my like synthesizing of like, whether it's podcasts I listen to, articles I read, whatever, to basically like get into an hour of somebody else's head and try to find a nugget that like really applies to me. And then there's the one to zero, right? Which is just like me with myself, which is just really, you know, kind of its own one-to-one like dialogue, right? And kind of getting in the zone and talking to myself actually, right? About, you know, whatever it is, like, where am I at? Where do I want to be? Where do I want the company to be? Just kind of talking, but talking out loud. Right? Not stewing those thoughts in the mind and kind of talking aloud. So if you're around me, you'd probably think, hey, this is a crazy person because they're literally talking to themselves. But it's something I do, you know, on a consistent, concerted basis a little bit. You know, I spend a little bit of time doing that, you know, every day or so. There's this really good, nice mindset framework that I like a lot, which I haven't started doing, but I learned about relatively recently, which is basically like this visualization framework of like visualize your goals, visualize where you want to be, and just say it, right? And like, it is going to happen, right? Like it is not if this is going to happen, it is when this is going to happen, and it is inevitable, right? And so I've started actually doing that a little bit more, like on a little whiteboard or a piece of paper or whatever, just like writing down, like, you know, in 2021 or in 2022, July 2nd, like this is going to happen, right? And then seeing, right? Like the more, like whether it happens or not is kind of irrelevant, to be totally honest. But the main thing is like that inner belief is just kind of there, and it wires you very differently. It's kind of like, you know, we talk about long-term thinking a lot. And I think one of the like worst things that's happened in like our generation is like everybody frantically checks their like Robinhood or their Coinbase or whatever, like every single day. And it's so funny because like on one hand, everybody's like, I'm a long-term investor. And on the other hand, it's like, you're literally looking at like your stocks or your crypto or whatever, like every single day, right? And I think that's really dangerous because it subconsciously rewires your brain. You can say you're super long-term oriented, but the reality is like when you're looking at something and you're getting that little like dopamine hit every single day, and you're subtly like this happens to me, like market's up, I'm a little happier, right? Why? Because I have a green screen on, right? Market's down, like maybe I'm a little bit like less happy that day, right? It starts to kind of creep into you also. And so I think it's really important. This is a little bit different than kind of what we're talking about, but I think it's really important kind of to have that long-term basis and not fall into the traps of rewiring your brain. So I try to take kind of, you know, solace or stock in like, how can I maximize each of those different mediums? Like what's the one to many for me? What's the one to one? What's the many to one? And what's the one to zero?
On the one to zero, have you ever recorded yourself with those, talking to yourself?
Yeah, you know, I haven't. It's funny. I've had folks suggest that, and folks that do that, I like hate the sound of my own voice. Like I totally will not listen to our podcast when you publish this. So I don't know how I feel about it, to be honest, but I know folks that have said it's like really life-changing. I'm very open to like experimenting with it and thinking about it.
Yeah. And on the visualization piece, was that something you have always been comfortable doing, or is that like a recent addition to your life? And if so, what caused the addition?
Yeah, much more recent. I think the older you get and the more in your career you go, just the more generally self-aware, hopefully, you become, right? And I think the more confident you become in kind of what's the game that you're playing, right? So like, I think this is one thing, you know, if in your audience, you have like young professionals or people looking for a first job, like this will be super helpful, right? Which is this idea that like most people that are really young fall into playing other people's games, right? And the challenge with that is like, it is basically a recipe for disaster, which is you're going to land up, you know, you might make a ton of money, you might have great titles, you might this, that, whatever it is. But at some point in time, you're basically going to wake up one day and be like, I don't want to do this anymore, right? Because all of those things, what turns out to be the case is like all of those other things like money or this or that are not self-sustaining, like motive, like they're not long-term self-sustaining motivators, right? Now, that's not to say that like having money isn't great. It relieves a lot of tensions and pressures and stuff in life, right? So like, I think a lot of the people that are like, who cares about money or getting rich is overrated, or like, no, there's a lot of people that are very happy because they have like flexibility. Like if anything, I think the best thing it does is advise you time and space and flexibility, and you can do whatever you want, right? But I think the biggest challenge when you're starting your career, or you're a young professional, is people fall into playing other people's games. And I think as you kind of grow in your stride, you start to figure out more and more what game really matters to you. And I think when you start to figure out what game really matters to you and you have more of a North Star, then I think all these tactics, like things like visualization and stuff, are super impactful. Because not only are you saying, hey, I'm going to drive the car on this road, not this road, but now you're very directly saying, I'm going to drive the car to this destination, not this destination. And when you start putting the visualization layer after that kind of self-awareness layer, it becomes a really powerful way to say, like, this is the journey I'm going on. And ultimately, whether you get there or not, is some combination of luck and skill and perseverance and all that other stuff. But at least you don't have the question mark of what is the journey that I'm going down. Now, that's not to say you need to be 25 and say, this is exactly what I'm going to do when I'm 35, 45, 55, 65. In fact, I think having a little bit of the Wild West tundra that we're driving down is great, because what you find in life is more and more serendipitous opportunity comes, the more and more interesting people you meet. And I'm a big believer that luck is like the surface area of like your opportunity and your work ethic and the people you know and kind of all that good stuff. But I think it's really helpful to play your own game, right? Like, I think that's really critical. And I think most people don't do that. And then I think all these other tactics like visualization and all that stuff are super helpful. So once I kind of internalized that, Danny, that's when I started using like these other kinds of tactics and stuff. It's been really helpful for me.
What game are you playing?
Yeah, it's the $1 million question, right? I think to me, what I figured out is like, I really, really enjoy actually not playing. So let me answer this in a couple of ways. So I think one way you can think about kind of playing a game is like, are you an operator? Are you an investor? Like what, like, you know, kind of buckets, right? And can you be the best at that? And there's kind of this adage of like, look, if you do too many of those things, you're kind of like, you're deluding yourself. Like you're really not going to be like the best or the greatest at any one of those things. And I know a lot of people that like, their goal is like, I want to be the best investor ever. I want to start and run and scale the biggest company ever. Right. A lot of the people I went to law school with are like, I want to be the president or I want to be a senator or whatever it is. Right. And they kind of have their like tactical thing. I think for me, what I get really energized by is actually not thinking about it as much as I want an end outcome, as much as what I really get energized by is a concept or a theme being at the center of kind of my orbit, right? So I really like this element of having, you know, intellectual curiosity at its core, and then having that be the spawn for all sorts of different things. So I do spend time actively investing. I've invested in over 50 companies. I do spend time obviously running a business, right? And we're, you know, 8 figures in revenue, growing fast, and have a little over 100 employees, right? I do really enjoy writing. I do really enjoy spending time on podcasts like this, or, you know, having my own podcast of sorts and interviewing interesting people. And so I look at the flywheel for me as, you know, the best kind of world is one in which I'm constantly learning, I'm constantly engaged, and I'm constantly intellectually curious. And all these other things are kind of their own products of sorts that spawn off of this. And as long as I'm in kind of this state of being where I do wake up and I'm energized and I'm interested, and it might not be like there, I think it's total BS to be like, I love every day when I'm like running our company. Like there are days I totally don't love it, right? I mean, I think it would be super disingenuous to say that. And I don't think anybody would believe that anyways, right? Like there are totally days where I'm like, oh, like I do not want to deal with A, B, and C that I know is on my plate for the day. There's also days where I'm like, I wouldn't want to do anything else in the world because like we are going to make such a big impact today, or the team is super pumped, or we're hiring all these people, or whatever it might be, right? Same thing on investing, same thing on writing, interviewing, you know, podcasting, all those different things, right? So I think the way I think about it is like, as long as I don't believe in like a concept of like make XYZ money and then like retire, right? Like, what are you going to do, right? Like that, I think that's like, that's really incongruent with the way I want to live my life, not incongruent with the way other people think of their lives, which is fine. But I think that's my North Star, right? I think what that allows for also is malleability and how that actually practically gets applied. But I think that's my North Star.
I think that's a beautiful North Star because it can be taken in so many different directions and it gives you the freedom to do what you want to do. It leads me to ask about a question that you had and you posed on a different podcast, I believe, which is like, this is the question that encapsulates that mindset, which is, do I feel like I'm learning and am I surrounded by good people? Yeah. Why did that question come to you? Because when I heard that question, I was like, whoa, that's a question that I need to start asking and thinking about often. So how did that question come to you?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest learnings for me in life, if there's a single commonality between like all the different experiences I've had, is all the positive experiences I've had have been some sort of function where like good people have been involved. and all the negative experiences I've had have been ones in which it's not that all negative or bad people were involved. It's that one or two bad people were involved, right? And on the good, what I'll say is it not just good people, but as good of people as you can find. And so I've formed a thesis around this. I think there's four reasons for why you want to be surrounded by good people. So I'll say the four, and then I'll kind of break each one out. So one is it helps you establish a standard. Two is it teaches you. Three is it motivates you. And then four is it creates opportunity for you. So let's break each one of those down. So the standard one, right? I think one of the biggest things when you're new to something is knowing what good looks like, right? Like most people don't know what good looks like. And excellent people define a bar. Like they define a benchmark, they define a threshold for you, and you can assess yourself against it. Now, it's completely up to you, right? Whether you want to perform lower than the bar, at the bar, or above the bar. And I don't say that flippantly. I say that from the perspective of, you know, there are moments in your life where you might say, it makes sense for me to be below the bar here, right? It's great that I know the standard, but that's not my aspiration. It's not congruent with what I need to be, so on and so forth, right? But I at least know what that standard is, right? I think getting to what is the standard in anything that you're attempting to doing as quickly as possible is really, really important. And the reason is, you know, it's very common, for example, when people run businesses and they don't know kind of what good growth looks like, it's very important to kind of settle, right? And let's say you do know that, hey, you know, good growth is 15% month over month growth. And I want to aspire towards that. If you're hitting 10% month over month growth, which to be clear is awesome, you're not settling for that delta 5%. Like you're actually pushing yourself to say, wait a minute, this is the standard for world class, right? So I think getting to a standard is really important. So that's number one. I think the second thing is the teaching you part. This is kind of similar to standard. It's a little bit more in depth. So it's not just about knowing what the line is, right? It's actually understanding how do you navigate the line. So let's take, you know, tennis as an example, right? So in the standard case, right, it's awesome when you're next to like, or let's take basketball, right? It's awesome when I'm next to a buddy that's a pro basketball player and I'm like, okay, I know what it takes, or I'm seeing what it takes to be a pro basketball player. Genetically, obviously I don't have it, but like, I don't know if I have it like work ethic wise. That's really intense, right? So that's the standard part. But the teaching part is it helps you really understand by being around like the best people, it really helps you understand all the other ancillary stuff, the mechanics, the tactics, the strategies, right? The navigation, how do you navigate the rules? How do you get your body right? How do you get your mind right? Like, what are all the components that are required to really execute against that standard that you've just learned? Again, it's your decision whether you want to execute it against it or not, but you've at least now been taught how can you, if you wanted to execute against that standard, how can you execute it? I think the third thing is it pushes you. So I'm in a CEO group with like 7-8 folks. It's a text thread. They're all similar age range. The youngest is, I think, 27. Oldest is 35. I'm like smack in the middle, right? At 31. And all have had varying degree of success. You know, some of them have sold their businesses for, you know, life-changing amounts of money. Some are in the course of building really great businesses and they're probably going to be bigger than all of us, but they're very in the course. Some are kind of, you know, closer to the end of that journey. Some are in the, you know, beginning of it. People are all over the place, right? But being in that group consistently pushes me personally. And it gives me a healthy pressure, right? Like, hey, I want to continue to be at the level that all these other folks are at and not drop behind, right? So I think it's a healthy kind of pressure. I don't think it's a negative kind of or unhealthy pressure, which is just a comparison game. Somebody's always going to have a bigger bank account. Somebody's always going to do X, Y, Z, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a healthy kind of way. And then I think the fourth is opportunity, right? When you're like, when you know good people, you're friends with good people, et cetera, like, all the serendipity that has happened in my career, whether it's like getting into a deal or making a hire or landing a customer or whatever it is, like so much of it is through just the serendipity of knowing good people, right? So I'm a big believer. I said this earlier. I'm a big believer. Luck is really the surface area of your work ethic, your network. And actually, I don't think I said this piece. I think the third variable of that is your personality, right? I think luck is the surface area of those three things. And you can really create, you know, you can create a lot of luck. So to me, solving for being, you know, around good people is a guiding principle. It's something I think through in any project I take on, any company I invest in, any group I interact with, anything in which I invest time, right? Like, we got to know each other, Danny, because we have a mutual friend, right? Like, for me to invest an hour and a half, for you to invest an hour and a half, I would want you to think I'm good people, right? Or I would want to think you're, you know, you're good people. So it's a framework. It's a kind of filtering mechanism I use for, you know, anything, whether it's not super serious or super serious, and everything in between, that I use for myself.
It's so fascinating watching your brain work, because I've seen you do this on other podcasts as well, where you take a concept, you break it down, and then you break it down after breaking it down again. And I'm saying to myself, is this like an outline? Like, it's so cool. So where does that come from? Your ability to break things down into its component parts and understand them and talk about them. Cause I'm like, whoa, my brain just doesn't work like that.
I appreciate that. I think it's funny. I don't think I'm very good at many things in life, but I do think I'm good at this. And I think the reason I'm good at this is because I've had the benefit of a lot of environments and a lot of training around this. I was a philosophy major in college, which is like totally not the like thing to do to get a job. Fortunately, I went to like a good enough school where that was fine. And I always wanted to go to law school, which was, you know, a little bit of a feeder into law school or being a lawyer. But philosophy really teaches you to, you know, articulate, read, deconstruct. It's actually, the misnomer around philosophy is like, it's actually not a fluffy subject at all, right? Like it's basically verbal math. And it's all on the basis of logical kind of construction, right? So that was a big, you know, there were a lot of hours and a lot of, you know, kind of, you know, time spent in kind of that realm. The time before that was, we talked a little bit earlier, kind of the debate piece, right? In high school, et cetera, timeframe. Then in life, you know, in kind of graduate school, going to law school, and just being in a very, very rigorous construct in law school, again, kind of distills and trains you to say, how can I identify something, break it down, you know, structure it, so on and so forth. And then I spent a couple of years at McKinsey, and this is probably the only skill you develop, candidly, at McKinsey, right? Which is, you know, take it for good or take it for bad, but it's, you get really damn good at structuring things, right? And really finding a way to say, okay, here's the component, you know, kind of set of issues. How do we distill this? What is mutually exclusive from one another? You know, what are kind of the logic trees by which we can bifurcate and kind of solve this problem? Because you're put into scenarios in which you have to get up to speed on an industry really quickly, a problem really quickly, and you don't have the luxury of time of actually learning everything and anything. It's like the age old, if you wanted to heat up the ocean or water in the ocean, what would you do? Would you go take the entire ocean and put it in a microwave or, you know, or boiling, you know, kind of plates or whatever? Probably not, because it would take forever to do. Or would you take cups out of the ocean and put that in the microwave, right? It's literally the antithesis of boiling the ocean, is kind of distilling as quickly as you can into the problem set, into the problem domain, and kind of isolating and figuring it out. So I've actually applied all those constructs to like everything I do in my life, right? And what that's allowed me to do, you kind of framed it, you know, very, very nicely. I think what it has allowed me to do, though, is be able to take things that seemingly seem pretty complicated. And in some cases, you know, they are more complicated, and others are a little more simplistic, but finding the root cause very quickly, isolating what is the problem statement very quickly, and then honing into the solution set. I think, like, and this is a little bit of a tangent, but like in business, so many times the problem is when there's a challenge, everybody conflates the problem and the solution. People go into solving very quickly, and they don't go into dissecting what is the problem. So this, by the way, is a huge risk. I talk to a lot of founders about when, you know, you're asking customers for feedback, right? So asking customers for feedback, fantastic. Obviously, you want to be super customer centric, super customer obsessed, et cetera. What customers are really good at, though, is they're really good at it saying, hey, I would do this, or you should put this in the product. What they're not as good at, which is through no fault of their own, but it's because of their limited vantage point, is saying, how do I broaden out the principle from what I'm telling you should put in the product? And what am I actually solving for, right? So really good product thinkers, or founders or executives for whatever domain they're in, are really, really good at actually discerning you know, what are all the different pieces of information that are coming? What are all the pieces of feedback that are coming out? And how do I dissect it into this very clean, logical way that makes sense? And then on top of that layer that I can communicate to people, I can communicate so that people actually understand, how do I get behind this, right? So much of the time, and it kind of goes back to our earlier example, we were talking about the friend that kind of couldn't raise and then, you know, they've raised and they're off to the races. There was nothing fundamentally wrong in the substance of that. But what was wrong was the logical structuring and then the articulation and the communication of it, right? So I think it's something that I tell folks, and it's kind of a skill that earlier in your life, you can kind of pick it up or really hone it or really focus in on it. It's a no regret kind of move to do, you know, really well and to get really good at.
What can someone listening right now do to get better at that skill?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the biggest thing for me that's been really helpful is probably two things, right? One is actually it's reading a lot and this goes back kind of to the intellectual curiosity point we were talking about. And you know, the cool thing is nowadays is like, it doesn't just have to be reading. It can be listening to a podcast, like whatever it is, right? Absorbing content, but absorbing a lot of content and then actually trying to actively distill it, right? So like, explain it to me like I'm five. Like if you had all this information and somebody didn't know anything, right? And you were explaining something to them or so, how would you be able to do it? Now you're taking kind of world experts, people that know topics kind of inside and out, are throwing tons and tons and tons of information. And what it forces you to do in that translation is basically to say, okay, how can I actually distill this to its easiest component foundational parts? And then if someone were to say, hey, that's really interesting and I understand this and we want to go to the next level, well, then that's the logic tree, right? So how do you then kind of break down into the next level and the next level? It's like the best visual analogy I have for this, and I totally forget the name of it, but it's like that Russian doll where like you have the really big doll, you open it, it's the smaller one, and you kind of keep opening and there's smaller and smaller and smaller dolls, right? Which is to say that oftentimes when you're digesting content, it actually starts at the small doll level. And the trick is how can you actually build it back up to the main doll and then follow that journey and follow that track, right? So I think absorbing lots of information, et cetera, is the key, because those are all these small kind of nuggets. And then really the training and the honing is to say, how can I absorb all these different pieces and how can I actually tie them together? And the more that you can tie them together and the more you can put an arch around them, the more you're resembling actually building that really big doll. And in building that really big doll, you have built naturally all the different layers that come, you know, to build that big doll.
That is such a crazy insight that when you listen to content or you listen to a podcast, what you're actually listening to is the smallest doll. And to get the most information out of it, you need to summarize it or think about it from a bigger picture so that you can have the bigger doll. Wow, that will stay with me.
Perfect example of this is like I was listening to a podcast the other day with Mark Andreessen. And I love it. I think Mark is like probably one of the smartest people in the world. And he was going really deeply, on kind of this topic of like, he was going very deeply into sectors that were on the opposite side of the technology price curve, right? Meaning if you look at, you know, things like, you know, TVs or hardware or so on and so forth, right? Obviously we all have like basically supercomputers that were better than what put a man on the moon, right, in our pockets via the iPhone, right? And there have been huge, huge deflationary curves, right, in those industries and those spaces. And if you look at the three sectors that are basically taking over the economy, it's healthcare, construction, and education, right? And those have gotten more and more expensive over a period of time. And Mark had this really articulate way of basically describing and extrapolating out the commonality between those three sectors to say effectively what has happened is we have restricted supply artificially and demand has continued to grow. And because demand has continued to grow and we've restricted supply, right, by definition, the price curve gets inverted. So things become more expensive. And then to satiate that, instead of unlocking supply, we have basically said, no, we will artificially help satisfy the demand. Federal loans, right? You know, federal subsidies for healthcare, so on and so forth, et cetera. And basically what that has done is it has made, you know, voters, you know, a little bit angrier, et cetera. Hey, I can't afford college, so on and so forth. So then there's more loans and then it's exacerbating the problem. And he had this whole kind of web to basically very cleanly articulate the problem statement, which was the reason we are having these challenges in these sectors is because we are on the opposite side of the technology price curve, right? And it was a classic example of going very, very deep into each of those and having each of those three kind of dolls seemingly or not related, but they all kind of bundled back up to that main doll, right? And so it's a very, it's a kind of construct or a mental model that I like a lot, because I think it really also allows you to understand if somebody really understands what they're talking about, which is, can they take you kind of, can they take distinct nuggets? Can they take those different dolls and can they actually make the big doll?
Damn, that's great. What was the podcast that was on?
It was Invest Like the Best with Patrick O'Shaughnessy. Okay. Mark Andrews. Cool. It was a recent
episode. We'll link that below.
It was great.
Thank you. So one way in which you did this for your team when you're working is a guide to working with Ramin. So you put all your thoughts and what you want for the company and everything you, your vision, you put it all on a Medium post, which I thought was so fascinating as a new CEO. That takes a lot of confidence and vulnerability. There's obviously a lot of benefits that can come from it, but what benefits did you find from it? And was it a difficult decision for you to actually put your thinking out there just online for everyone to see?
Yeah. So the backstory here, which is probably helpful, is so when I joined Metasys, the first 60 days were jam-packed, right? Like I got into the trenches with every person in our company. At that time, it was probably like 70-ish folks, right? We scaled since then. But just to understand how they saw the organization, right? What were their challenges? Where did they see the opportunity? What was working well? What was terrible? What needed to change? You know, so on and so forth. And that process actually forced me to reflect quite a bit, right? On what does it take to be an effective leader? And I think it's a pretty uncontroversial statement to say that, you know, being an effective leader requires clarity and transparency, clarity of thought, right? Transparent communication, a pretty scientific methodology, I'd say, around alignment, right? But I found in a lot of the examples that folks were sharing with me that in practice, that's where a lot of those value statements were becoming really muddy, right? And so people would say, like, nobody's going to disagree with you that, like, yeah, we should have clear communication. Like, how do you disagree with that statement, right? But the question is like, are you actually clearly communicating, right? And can you actually clearly communicate? So I saw a lot of the misunderstandings, frustrations, et cetera, loom, you know, pretty simply due to miscommunication. And so that was one side of it. The other side of it is like, I'm a big fan of show, don't tell. Like, I don't like tell and talk. I like show, right? So, you know, when people write on Twitter and kind of they postulate about a theory or so, my first question is like, what has this person done? Like, if they're talking about building a business, like, how big is their business? Have they built it? Have they been a part of it? What gives the credibility? Like, what allows you to show, don't tell, right? And so I thought there was really low-hanging fruit opportunity to actually show, not tell, my leadership and the company around being as clear and transparent as possible. And the way I thought about that was, why don't I write how I like to work? And it's super important because I'm new to the organization. So I think one of the most important things when you get hired in as a CEO that a lot of folks really struggle with is like, it's not the Ramin show, right? Metasys existed before Ramin came into the picture, and it grew to a pretty good scale. And a lot of these people have been at the company for a long time, and they have been the ones that built this business. So the worst thing you can do for yourself is kind of walk in and be like, I've got all these frameworks and I've got all these plans and this is what we're going to do. And that's actually the worst thing you can do, right? As a hired in CEO, especially. I think that's the case, you know, if you're a founder scaling your company, you know, et cetera as well, but certainly as a hired in CEO. In my consulting days, whenever we kicked off a new project, we did a pretty cool thing. We called it a team learning. So the idea was basically, you know, you're on a new project every 3-4 months, you're with a new group of people, you don't know those people, right? And so you're at the same firm, et cetera, but you don't really know those people. So the team learning was kind of a host of topics, right? You talk about personality type, aspiration, pet peeves, your routine, what was going on personally that was of specific importance to you. So like, I remember an engagement I was on, my wife and I were like, within 2 months, we were getting married. So like wedding planning and all that was like a big thing on my mind at that point in time, right? You know, what are your goals? What are your learning and development goals? Whatever it might be, right? when you're in a business, that dynamic shifts, right? Because you're not working with a fully brand new set of folks every 3-4 months, right? Organizations do change. You continue to grow, you hire new people in, et cetera. But you have your core teams. It's not that kind of dramatic of a turnover every couple of months, right? Now, we were anticipating pretty material growth. We were fortunate to kind of execute upon that. I knew our headcount would go up. We had a pathway where we said over the next couple of years, we're going to grow our headcount by 50%, right? And so the best thing that I could think of was, okay, how can I take all these different things and put them together? How can I come into the organization and not be the one that's top down saying all my ideas? How can I show, not tell? How can I take what was positive from those team learning kind of exercises and adapt it to our kind of organization? And how can I kind of blend all those things together to get people to know me better and do it in a scalable way, right? It lives in our companies, like Microsoft Teams, and people can go check it out and people can put their own documents and other people can check it out and so on and so forth. The best example I'd seen of someone doing this and where I really kind of stole the idea from was Claire Hughes Johnson at Stripe, right? I think she really coined kind of this concept of developing, she developed a working guide to Claire. And it's basically this idea of like how all her execs, interact with her, but it's available for everybody at Stripe to actually see, right? So I took huge inspiration from that. I structured mine into a couple of different sections, like things like personality type, operating principles, communication style, how do I like to be in meetings, et cetera. And what I found, Danny, is like a lot of these things are just things that people don't feel the need to talk about. Look, I don't think it's the most effective use of time either to set up 1-hour meetings with 3 people at a time and everybody talk about their preferences. Like, you'll never get anything done as a company. So I'm totally cognizant of the practical side of this, which is where I err, by the way. Like, I love frameworks and mindsets and all that stuff, but I'm a super practical, action-oriented person. Like, it only makes sense to me if we can actually adapt this and then create impact, right? If we're just talking about it, it sounds nice, it feels good, but it doesn't really actually get us anywhere. But I loved this one because this was really kind of, it allowed me to tie all those different elements I just talked about together and really put myself out there to say, hey, there's no reason why you should know some of these like ticks or great practices or weird things about me or whatever it is, but this is who I am. And this is the way I like to operate. And by the way, this isn't a mandate. This isn't a set of rules just because I'm the CEO, but these are things for you to be aware of. And by the way, I would love to be aware of the things that kind of tick you a different way or really motivate you or whatever it might be as well. Because at the end of the day, we're trying to be the most effective team we can be possible, right? We're not a family, right? We can fire each other. We can move on, right? You can't do that with your siblings or your parents or whatever it is, right? And so we need to operate like a team. And how can we be put in a position where, we're the best team that we can possibly be? So I thought that was an interesting kind of exercise and an interesting way to share that with the group.
How do you deal with when inevitably you change as a human being? I'm wondering if there's anything in that document that doesn't reflect you anymore because you've changed as a human being, as we inevitably all do. Yeah. And, someone says, oh, Ramin's this type of person. And actually 2 years later, you're a slightly different type of person. How do you think about that?
I think it's 2 things. I think one is it's really healthy not to think of that as like a PhD thesis, right? It's a working document. And I think you should always treat it as a working document because you should continue to reflect on it and update it, every 6 months, every year, whatever the right cadence is, whatever the right level, whatever has changed in your life, right? Like, you should react to that to make that a working document. So I think that's really important, right? I think to your kind of the tactical question of like, well, what has changed or so, I think I've become a lot more patient as I've been a CEO for longer. Things do take a lot longer than you think they're going to take. For action-oriented people, it's one of the most frustrating things possible. But I think it's recognizing that some things take longer, and that has nothing to do with the flaws of your organization or people's capabilities or whatever it is. And that's not something, Danny, I'll tell you, that's not something I always internalized. Like, early on, if things weren't happening fast enough, I'd be like, this person's bad, we need to fire them, or like, what's going on here, right? But it takes a maturity and it takes a time frame to really understand that things actually do take a long time, right? And that's just like the way the world is, and that's the way things are, and et cetera. And so, you know, I had a lot of things, I think early on, that I'd written about, like meetings or operating practices or whatever, that were very like, you know, to the T, like almost demanding absolute perfection, you know, from this meeting. And if it's not perfect, like we can't do it, and so on and so forth. And I think I've relaxed that quite a bit, right? Which is not to say I've lowered my standard, to go back to our earlier kind of concept, right? Which is not to say I've lowered the standard. I'm still aware of the standard, but I'm more aware in situations in which the standard can be lowered and it is okay. We can move beyond that, right? So it's having that cognizance and that self-awareness to understand, you know, where are there, you can know the bar, you can know the standard, but you can also know, you know, in which situations, which opportunities, et cetera, is it okay to relax the bar, you know, and what does that mean, right? So I look at it very much as a working document. And I think if you don't look at it as a working document, it's actually more of an indictment on yourself, because it means you're not growing and learning and reflecting and moving, right? I'm a big fan of people that get facts and change their minds. I'm not a big fan of people that kind of have this like, well, I formed an opinion, and so I got to stick with the opinion.
What do you think is the result of you becoming more patient?
Good question. A couple of things. So one is, I think it is easier for me to feel comfortable with myself as a leader. Because I think it's very easy when you're leading a company to be so results and output driven, where if the results and outputs don't come, you kind of put it as an indictment on yourself. And I think if you have a little bit more of a patience to it, then you can recognize, you can kind of sift the forest from the trees and kind of get an understanding of where are there areas where it is my fault, where are there areas it's not my fault, where are there areas it's a market condition, where there are areas it's a company condition, et cetera. I think you have a little bit more clarity to kind of diagnose the actual problem, right? So I think that's one part of it. I think the other part of it is it just makes you more tolerable to work with, right? Like I tell this to like our leaders or people in our company all the time, which is like, practice patience, right? And learn patience, because nobody likes working with the person, you know, that's not patient. Now, again, that's not to say lower your standard. That's not to say let's move slower. Like, don't conflate speed with patience. A lot of people do that. A lot of people think that patience means, let me just be nice. Let me say, okay, I understand, and let it like take, you know, 3 days to get done. No, you don't lower your standard, right? You don't lower your intensity, your speed, et cetera, but you increase your patience. Patience is about understanding. Speed, capability, all that stuff is about execution, right? So I think it really helps, actually, the more mature you can get as a leader and you can understand and actually unpack that patience and speed are different things. And I think they're too often conflated. I think it makes you a much more tolerable person and a better person to work with. And that's at any level, right? Whether you're the CEO or the most junior person in the company, I think it just makes you a better person to work with.
Mm. Macro patience, micro speed is something Gary Vaynerchuk often says, and couldn't have said it better there. With this conversation, I feel as if you're incredibly present. I've noticed like an incredible presence from you, and you must have a million things going on and a million things in your head and a million people to deal with in this direction, that direction. How do you maintain that presence throughout a conversation when you have so many things going on?
I'm not perfect at it by any stretch. If I was being honest with you, saying like, I'm not thinking about this client, we have a big meeting this afternoon, or I'm not thinking of, you know, this, this partnership that we've been working on, or, I mean, those thoughts are going through my head, right? It's a couple of things. So one is I turn notifications like off of everything I do. I have set times in which I look at things. I'm not perfect at this, by the way, right? Like I'm working on this a lot. But it's important. It goes back to kind of that rewiring early on we were talking about. Like, I don't need to look at my email every time an email comes to me. That's reactive, right? Like, I need to go into my inbox when I have the time to go into the inbox, not when somebody decides to write an email and send it to me. Because their construct or their day, it made sense for them to do that at that point in time in their day. It might not make sense for me to do this at this point in the day, right? That's one element. Once I take off notifications and all that stuff, it's really helpful because I don't really have an option but to focus, right? Because otherwise, like, what am I looking at? There's nothing really other for me to be doing because I don't have that external stimuli that's coming in. That's one part of it. The second part of it is you get better output from when you are engaged. So I'm a firm believer, like, if you're going to do something, like if we're going to do this podcast and we talked about it and I've committed to you, then I need to be here with you for the time that I've committed to be here with you, right? Now, the minute that we're done, I'm going to go race to the next thing, right? And that's, you know, that's just what I'm going to do. That's how I have a productive day. But it's really important to do that. The other thing is I take breaks during the day. Like, I'm not a firm believer at all into like 9 to 5, sit at your computer, so on and so forth. And I tell our team this also. I said, look, like, if you're the kind of person that, like, especially in a remote world, et cetera, like, you want to get a workout in at 3 o'clock, or, you know, you want to take an extra hour and a half with your kid or whatever it might be, do that. Why? Because when you do log back on or you do engage, you're going to do it with an intensity and an urgency. You're going to be way more productive, right? Like, if you're not fully productive at 4 o'clock, don't waste your time on the computer. And then later, you know, you're going to be doubly upset. You're not going to spend the time with your family that you want. You're still going to have to do work, right? And you're not going to have been as productive in that moment. So take the time, right? Like, take the break, take the step away, whatever it might be. Again, we have to have a standard, right? Everybody in the company can't just start taking 3-hour breaks in the middle of the day. Otherwise, nobody can contact each other, right? But be clear with your team. Like, if that's how you like to work and you don't have an external client meeting, or, you know, you don't have a customer calling you, or whatever it is, it's cool. Like, if you guys all want to work from 7 to 9 and not from 1 to 3, do it. It doesn't matter to me, right? And that, I've internalized that for myself, which is super important. Like, I, like, a couple, probably 2-ish months ago, I was like, okay, I'm sitting too much. I need to work out more. Like, I need to really, like, get in the zone. Like, I need to start moving, et cetera. And so I, like, 4:30, like, 3 days a week, I'm on a Peloton now. And, like, I don't schedule any calls at 4:30. Like, that's just my thing, right? Like, I just don't schedule calls or whatever. And I'm locked in. Like, I do a 30-minute ride and then, like, 30 minutes of, like, shower, change, like, this, that, the other, whatever it might be. And, like, that's my time, right? So I think it's just actually, like, the biggest thing, Danny, is just taking control of your time and your schedule and being really intentional about doing that. And I find that, you know, most people think they can't do that. But what I would really encourage most people to do is actually, if you do that, I think you can actually work less hours because you'll have more productive hours. And I think you'll just be energized, like, more. Like, you can decide whatever you want to do. If you want to work more, I think you're going to be a better worker. I think if you don't want to work more, like, congrats, you just saved more hours in your week, right? Like, I think it's a healthier way to think about, you know, like, world, like, the world, your life, et cetera. And so I'm not perfect at it by any stretch, but I'm working on it, like, pretty significantly.
Yeah. And I also notice a lot of empathy in what you're saying. You know, you're allowing people to take breaks if they need to. And it's way different than I think a managerial or CEO style from 50 years ago might be. What has led to an increased level of empathy from your perspective as a CEO?
Yeah, I think it's two things. So one is, I think it's naturally more of my personality type. I am the kind of person, like, I care what other people think. Like, I like when people are happy, right? And that can be a flaw. Like, that can be I'm a big believer strengths and weaknesses are two sides of the same coin. So I think that can totally be a weakness. But I think it's a huge strength as well, right? I really care how people feel. Like, I care if they are happy, if they feel good. It's not just about, did we hit these numbers, you know, et cetera, because I'm a firm believer that if you're happy, like, you're gonna work that extra hour. Like, you're gonna go that extra mile for that customer that you have, that teammate that you have, whatever it might be, right? So I think part of the empathy comes from just caring, you know, caring about people, caring what other people think, having a lot of great friends, having a great relationship with my family, having a great marriage, all those things, I think give me empathy that I want that for other people. Like, I want people to genuinely be happy, right? I think that's one part. And then I think the other part is, and this is probably actually tied, you know, this is, I kind of said this actually. So this is, it's probably that one core reason. The other part I was going to say is, I really firmly believe that if you are in a good place, you are a better worker, right? And so if I were to dissect kind of the one and two, I think that the more I say it out loud, the more it sounds like the same thing. But the only way I would dissect it is like one is more of a internal personality trait, which is where empathy comes from. And I think the other is a top-down personality trait, which is, I think, to be the best CEO you can be, which ultimately your one job is to be the best, is to be the steward of the company, right? Whether it's strategy, hiring, recruiting, inspiring, sales, like whatever you want to do, like your job is to be a good steward of the company, period, right? And I think being a good steward of a company is hiring really good people and then having those people do really good work. And I think the only way you do that is if people are good, like if they're happy, right? And it doesn't hurt to be empathetic to people and their needs. And ultimately that delivers back. Like we have people at our company that literally this coming week, I have one of our execs, I told her, I was like, I do not want you working this whole week. It's not holiday, like it's not company holiday. There's no time you need to put in. Like you are taking the week off because she has busted her ass the last 2.5 months and crushed it this last quarter. And I don't want her to burn out, right? Because A, I care about her. So I'll take that kind of the personal side, right? And then B, she's a great contributor to the team. Like we need her, you know what I mean? And so it's both of those angles, I think, of that bottoms up and that top down side. But I have never seen, I've seen empathy to a fault. I don't believe in that. It's something I work on, right? Which is to say, like, don't let people's feelings get in the way of the outcome. You have to maintain that standard. But I don't see many examples where people are empathetic and people go, you know, gee, I just don't really want to work at that company. It's funny, I had a podcast episode where I got into a pretty heated debate actually with the guest who was telling me they had a totally different perspective on this. So for everybody listening, like take it with a grain of salt. There are smart, successful, accomplished people out there that think everything I just said on this particular question, they'd take the total flip side of, and they've seen it succeed. I think the piece I would take it one level higher is you can have a debate on kind of the success, no success part. I personally don't think that's a super happy way to live. And so, you know, take it with that grain of salt that at the very least of all you get out of it is like good personal outcome, then at least you get good personal outcome.
Yeah, that reminds me of a book that was very influential to you, which was How Will You Measure Your Life by Clay Christensen. Yeah. And you know, why was that book so impactful in putting it in this the context of this conversation?
I think Clay, I was unlucky not to take a class with Clay. I knew Clay when I was at HLS, and he's of course, you know, unfortunately passed since then. But Clay Christensen, for everybody listening, legendary professor, kind of the father of innovator's dilemma, right? And disruptive innovation. So whenever we talk about disruption and, you know, innovation, et cetera, Clay Christensen is, you know, the guy, literally the guy that came up with the framework for how you think about this. So Clay wrote this book. He was classmates with Jeffrey Skilling, the CEO of Enron. And of course, you know, Enron, huge fraud debacle, et cetera. Skilling went to prison, et cetera. And he reflected and he was like, you know, like Jeff was like a good guy at HBS, right? Like we were all friends. We were in our 20s. Like he was a good guy. He was just a good, normal guy. Like nobody would have said, if you were to sit in the room and like look 30 or 40 years ago, like that was the like guy that was going to end up in prison and this and commit fraud and like all that stuff. Right. So Clay's kind of like the thesis for him to write that book was basically like, what happened? Right. The interesting thing is he broadened it out much more at a much more macro level to like all of his students. And he said that, you know, I've been teaching at HBS for 30 plus years and I've noticed this pattern, which is like everybody comes back for the 1 year reunion. You know, they're fresh in like the market and their jobs and they're talking about their visions of the world and everybody's basically the same person, et cetera. 5 years less people would show up, 10 years less, 20 years less, you know, and on and on and on. And when you kind of dissected it more and more, you would see that like more and more people were basically embarrassed to go back to their reunions. They had divorces, they had estranged family situations, they got fired from a job, like whatever it might be, right? They basically had the challenges that come in life. And so he wrote this book because he was basically like, you know, you have all these smart, nice, good people. And, you know, a lot of them, like none of them would have said if they were in the HBS classroom, like, yep, at 40, I want to be divorced. Like nobody says that, right? Or like, yep, I don't want to talk to my kids or whatever it might be, right? But these are the outcomes that these people kind of, you know, got into or so. And I could really empathize with that because I love law school. Like I made my best friends at HLS, right? And there are so many awesome people. And now, you know, being 5-6 years out, I've seen it. I've seen people get divorced or this or that or whatever it is. Like they're dealing with life circumstances. And so his whole book was basically around like coming up with frameworks to say, it's really easy to get sucked into professional goals because professional goals, they're tactical things to measure. It's very hard to measure not being at the dinner table every night, but at some point in time, the switch kind of flips and that's where a relationship crumbles. And so the whole premise of that book is focus on the things that are hard to measure because those are the things that you don't get a gold star for, you don't get a raise, you don't get a title, you don't really get external recognition. But at the end of the day, like, isn't that what we all live for, right? And like at the end of the day, isn't that how you should measure your life? And so I love that book. It totally changed my life and my perspective on things. And I encourage people to read it because it's not, Clay doesn't tell you how you should measure your life. He challenges you to think and ask the question, right, of how you should measure your life.
So beautifully said. And I'm looking forward to checking that book out. Before we go to a close, Ramin, what is advice you would give to a 22-year-old who wants to pursue the highest version of themselves, whether that's physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually? What advice would you have for that person?
Yeah, man, it's such a tough question. I think the biggest thing is like, the earlier on in life you can, I'm gonna pull back a lot of the themes I talked about because I really think it's not like this new groundbreaking insight. It's a little bit of a combination of what we've talked about today. I think self-awareness, intentionality, and surrounding yourself with good people, like that's all I'd focus on. If I was like young and trying to make it and whatever it is, like my reflections are that's led to everything good that's happened to me. That's led to a lot of good things that have happened to people I know that have done extremely like orders of magnitude better than I have. Those are the three things like that matter. Skills, work ethic, all of those things matter, right? Those are all tactical. Those all matter, et cetera. But like the three philosophical, I think, guiding points are self-awareness, right? Surrounding yourself with good people and intentionality. You can be intentional and dabble in things. That doesn't mean you need to pick something instantly, or you can be intentional and really hunker down, but just be intentional. I think those are the three kind of guiding points, Danny, I would tell your audience.
I love it. And where can people find you for more and to connect with you further?
Yeah, I'm at Ramin Sheth on Twitter. I write a lot about like these types of things. I try to tweet as consistently as I can. I'm not the best at it, but I try to put my thoughts kind of like we were talking about earlier, right? Like that one to end kind of version. I try to put my thoughts out and, you know, and hopefully it's helpful to folks. So follow me on Twitter and that's pretty much, you know, typically where I'm at kind of from an online perspective.
Awesome. And I'll put that below. Thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Danny. Thanks for having me on and great questions.
Hope you enjoyed that episode with Ramin Sheth. If you have any thoughts or feedback about this episode, let me know on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda. Until then, I really, truly appreciate you listening. As always, it means the world to me from the bottom of my heart, and I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts about this episode. But until then, I will see you in the next one. Have a great day or night. Peace.